I start by the Jewish word shalom.
I also antagonize a lot of people by recognizing the State of Israel as soon as it was formed. Well, I had been to Potsdam, and I'd seen some of the places where the Jews had been slaughtered by the Nazis.
Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region.
If the world governments do nothing, what will you do?
We'll have to protect ourselves.
How?
We'll see the best way we can.
No Daylight with Rachel Azaria.
So hi to Einat Vilf, a former member of the Knesset, of the Israeli parliament. We weren't together in the parliament. We were two terms apart. And the author of Why We Should All Be Zionists. I'm very happy to have you here with us, discussing towards the Israeli Independence Day, Zionism, Judaism, Tikkun Olam, universal ideas, particular ideas. So glad to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And we're going to start as usual. If you can please choose one of the segments of the Declaration of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and if you want to read it.
Read it in Hebrew?
So you can read it both in Hebrew and in English. I'll open it also in English, and you can read it in English too.
Okay, so in Hebrew, I'm choosing the middle section, essentially the declaration. לפיכך, נתכנסנו אנו חברי מועצת העם, נציגי היישוב העברי והתנועה הציונית, ביום סיום המנדט הבריטי על ארץ ישראל, ובתוקף זכותנו הטבעית וההיסטורית ועל יסוד החלטת עצרת האומות המאוחדות, אנו מכריזים בזאת על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל, היא מדינת ישראל.
And you read that and like I almost want to start clapping, right? It's like so exciting. We can't believe that's the state of Israel.
We did it.
That's the declaration.
And now
read it in English.
Please
make sure to do it with the same excitement.
Okay. Accordingly, we, members of the People's Council, representatives of the Jewish community of Eretz Israel and of the Zionist movement, are here assembled on the day of the termination of the British mandate over Eretz Israel, and by virtue of our natural and historic right, and on the strength of the resolution of the United Nations General Assembly, hereby declare the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel to be known as the State of Israel.
Yay!
Yay! Yeah, now we go dancing.
Yeah. Okay. So why did you choose it?
First of all, because it's the declaration. And indeed, it has that moment. Because the way that the declaration is built, and if I may, to highly recommend, I think Martin Kramer has a three-part essays over how the declaration was written.
Yeah.
So the first half basically kind of builds our rights,
right,
kind of why we have the right to a state, why we have the right over this land. So it's kind of all the whys. And then from here on, it talks about what kind of state it's going to be. But this is the moment that brings it all together. Every word here, every phrase has meaning. The fact that it's both the Zionist movement and the people already in the land of Israel. On the day that the British mandate over the land of Israel, the critical issue here is they speak of our natural and historic right. One of the things that I find remarkable that this is, on the one hand, it's not a religious document, but it has a sacred feel and it has a certain religiosity to it. But the right about which they speak is about the natural and historic right. I am a very secular person. My Twitter handle even mentions that I'm an atheist. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, oh, you're an atheist, but you think God gave you this land. You know, how moronic is it? And I always explain, it's not about a God giving. It's about a historic connection that was maintained every day, every minute, every hour by a people dispersed through their memory, through their rituals, through their words. So I love that this document speaks about the historic right, but they also bring the United Nations General Assembly. They bring both the historic right, the natural right, but also the fact that we received the blessings twice. We received the blessings of the League of Nations.
Yeah.
That's how the British Mandate was constituted. And then the United Nations General Assembly. And the naming, the first of all, the fact that it's a Jewish state in the land of Israel, that's important. You know, as part of the battle within Israel, I think that the brilliance of Zionism is that when it had to make a decision, it chose sovereignty over every square inch of the land. And that's why we have a state. Because at the critical moment, just like in your personal life, in a national life, your character comes through in your key decisions. We all want everything. The question is, what happens when we have to choose? And when the Jewish people, when the Zionist movement had to choose, you can have your state, you can have sovereignty, but you're not getting the land. You're getting just parts of it. We chose sovereignty, and that's why we have a state. So the fact that we declared a Jewish state in the land of Israel, rather than every square inch, I think was critical to our success. And finally, the naming of Israel. I recently wrote a piece for Sapir on the history of the name Palestine and why, until it was hijacked in the 60s, everyone understood it to mean Jewish. It was actually the colonial Roman and Christian name that everyone understood to be the geographical area where the Jewish homeland once was, which is why the League of Nations, when it constitutes the mandate, it says that it recognizes the historic connection between the Jewish people and Palestine, which only makes sense if everyone understands that it's Jewish. And this is the grounds for reconstituting. They use the word re. They're basically saying, we know you were here, and because you were here and you have a historic connection and you never disassociated from this connection, you have the right to reconstitute yourself here. But when the Jewish people finally have the right to name their country, they actually do what every self-respecting nation does at the time. They shed the colonial name. Palestine was the colonial name, the name given by foreigners, by the Romans, by the Christians. And they give it our indigenous name, Israel. So it's all here in this one paragraph. I love it.
I agree. I mean, I love it too. And it's also interesting because the beginning of the paragraph is therefore.
Yeah, therefore.
Lefichach is therefore. The beginning of the paragraph is therefore. And before, when the declaration was written, the first stage, so every one of the paragraph was started with whereas,
exactly.
And then all of this becomes therefore.
Yeah.
And Ben-Gurion erased all the whereas. He didn't like it. It sounded.
Shalit was very angry.
Yeah. There was a big argument about it. But the therefore lasted. It stayed.
Yes,
yeah.
It stayed.
Yeah.
And still has that power.
It still has that power. Yeah. And the whole idea is that the Declaration of Independence, it goes through all the reasons we deserve a state.
Exactly.
And it's also interesting to see that there are many, as you said, there's also the religious reason and also the natural reason and also the fact that we've always thrived towards Israel and the fact, and also the Balfour Declaration and the Zionist movement. And like there are many, many, many reasons. And the Holocaust.
Yes.
Many reasons that bring us to this, like, amazing moment that we can say, yes, we deserve it. And it's also because that I think everyone was worried and apparently they knew what they were doing, that it won't be obvious to people that we have the right to have our country.
Yes.
And that it won't be obvious to people that we have a right to have our country in Israel.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I'm sitting with you and talking and suddenly I realize how much of what's happening today is, I don't know if they foresaw it. I don't know if the people that wrote the Declaration of Independence, if they foresaw this, if it was that way, like, you know, because because after a long fight, we got a state. And it could have been the moment that all of this argument of whether we deserve a state or not could have been over.
So first of all, they were already, to say, graduates of several decades of a battle to get legitimacy for that state. The Zionist movement, when Herzl conceives of Zionism as a political movement rather than just a longing, he understands that a critical element will be to get legitimacy from bigger, larger powers. He has nothing. He has nothing except his vision, his words, and he understands that he needs to build legitimacy.
Right. So from the beginning, he works very hard for legitimacy.
Exactly. So from the beginning, there's an understanding that we are making our case. And for decades, this is already after 30 years of battles against the existence of a Jewish state, where again and again there are efforts to undermine it. So the people who are writing it are very much aware that it's not just a matter of foresight. They understand that in real time, there is a battle for the legitimacy of a Jewish state. So they're making the case.
Yeah. Do you think they foresaw it?
That it will be an endless battle?
Yeah.
Some of them, maybe, but I think none of them would have expected it to be so brutal, so global, so vicious. I think they believed that once we had a state, yes, they knew we would have to fight for it, but I think they expected that at one point the world would move on.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Declaration of Independence was during the War of Independence.
Yes.
And also the first election was during the War of Independence. A very long war, the War of Independence.
Yes. A very long war, a very brutal
war. Brutal war.
This declaration, of course, opens the major and the most dangerous stage, which is the stage when Arab armies essentially invade the land in order to prevent the Jewish state from coming into being. This ends what you would call the civil war. I always tell people that if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict had ever been just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that is the Jews and Arabs between the river and the sea, that conflict was over in April 1948. In April 1948, essentially the Jewish forces are able to control the parts of the land that ultimately become the state of Israel, and those are the parts that they ultimately defend against the Arab invasion. But the reason that the conflict has persisted for so many decades is precisely because it was never just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Jewish-Arab civil war. It was always part of a far bigger battle against the existence of a Jewish state by Arab forces, by the Soviets, Iran now. There were always other people happy to support the Palestinians in their battle against the Jewish state.
So what do you think is happening today?
In many ways, the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I said we read it and we look at it and it's, yeah.
Yes, we are. The idea, I think what the founders of the State of Israel and of early Zionism, I think what they perhaps underestimated is how difficult it would be for the world to accept the idea of a sovereign Jew. And that it would be a theological challenge of such proportions that the world would not be able to go back to business as usual. If you think about it, half of the world sits either on a Christian or a Muslim cultural basis. Each one of them, for their own reasons, has a theological history that, shall we say, at the minimum, is problematic to the idea of a sovereign equal Jew. Zionism is a theological challenge in many ways, also to Judaism, in that it says the Jew is now going to be equal, sovereign, upright, confident, a master of their fate. This is a massive challenge for cultures that for millennia, for centuries, were used to thinking of the Jew as meek, dispossessed, weak, at their mercy. Sometimes they protect the Jew, sometimes they use the Jew as a scapegoat, but they decide, not the Jews. So for the Jews to basically say, we decide, this is what this declaration says, we're deciding, we're masters of our own fate, I think they underestimated the theological, sociological, cultural shock that this would present to a world that has already been used to a certain vision of what a Jewish person is.
It's, I have to say, I first of all, this is a very interesting perspective. I think that in Israel, we're always trying to escape from the religious conflict because I think it terrifies us. And also, it makes us wonder if this can ever change. And I think that I know people think different about Israel, but we really don't like wars. We really don't like them. We do everything we can to avoid war. Yeah. And I think that thinking that it's a theological conflict is something that's just, it's too much to grasp. I wonder, we're here for a while already. And I think it goes back to this discussion that we're having about how much did they understand in the Declaration of Independence? How much did the Israeli forefathers, how much did they realize the future? And, there was a while, like also Christianity and Islam, I think they could kind of think about it in a different way. So I wonder if it's only about a shock, because you know what? If it's about a shock, so it's something that could be mended. There is a Muslim, he's the head of one of the Muslim courts in Israel. Dr. Yad, I forget his name. One second, let me. Okay, Potzach Laroch, Shnia, Yad. There we go. One second. Yad Bet Adin Ashari. Yad Chalka. Okay, so he's the head of the Sharia, of the Islamic, the Sharia court in Israel, Dr. Yad Chalka. He's a very interesting person, and we had quite a few discussions. And he wrote a book about one of the notions that he discusses a lot is about Islam being a minority. Islam is used to being a majority, not used to being a minority. We're used to being a minority. We're not used to being a majority. We need to rediscuss how we're going to be a majority. And I think this is part of the Zionist movement. And also, I think it's also part of the negotiation where we are as far as universal ideas, particular ideas. And basically says also the Islam has to do some of that work. And, I think that this is part of the optimism that we had here for a few years, thinking that there is a way to figure it out. I'll even say more so, I'm a Jerusalemite. Mm-hmm. And we say in Jerusalem, and I have to say that sometimes I believe in it more and sometimes less, but in good days, we say maybe instead of thinking of Jerusalem as the heart of the conflict, as, where everything falls apart or doesn't work, let's look at Jerusalem as like the crown jewel. This could be where we solve the conflict. And if we bring in, the qadis and the rabbis and the priests, and we think of everything, with a lot of goodwill. And also in Islam, there was a lot of there were big, I don't know if trends, but something happened. I remember the big this big group of Qadim, that Qadim and heads of Islam movement that went to Auschwitz, and they held this very beautiful prayer, and it was just a few years ago, just before COVID, I think, like, you know, less than 5 years ago. And I remember there was a moment that was like, okay, maybe this can work. So
you're absolutely right that in terms of thinking about theology, precisely because I'm not a religious person, I look at theology. Theology is from people. It's not, and all religions are from people. They're not really from God. At the end of the day, they're all systems of interpretation and meaning, which means they can change. The best religious leaders, what do? They change the interpretation, and then they tell you that that's what God really wanted, right? This is what was really always meant.
I'll say, but I'm Orthodox yeah. feminist. I'm religious. And the way we do it, I mean, you're saying it a bit cynically, and I understand, but like in Orthodox feminism, so we go back and we say, look, already in Bereshit, in the first chapter, so there is an option that the woman was like, the woman was created from the man. And just the next paragraph is that both the man and the woman were created equally. And so I just want to say that it's not, we don't go and say that's what, I think we really go back off into text and search for our ideas and our notions, kind of also what we're doing here with the Declaration of Independence. I think mm-hmm. that what Jews do is we always go to like great texts to look for answers. So,
and all religions, by the
that's
way,
what we
all
do.
All
yeah.
religions are systems of interpretation, which means, and because the texts, as you described, the texts can give way to so many different interpretations. So just as Christianity was initially built on a theology of Jewish dispossession, and the first Christian churches are built on the ruins of the Temple Mount. This is why the Temple Mount is free territory for the Muslims to build a mosque. This is why it's unused, yeah. even though it's in the center. But then with the Reformation, you have the rise of Christian Restorationism, that rather than looking at Jewish powerlessness as key to Christianity, it looks at the restoration of the Jews in the land as something that is inherent to Christianity. It's just a different interpretation. In the same way, I believe that Islam and the Arab world can go through the same process. And we're already seeing it happen in some places, where rather than look at the Jewish state as a foreign implant, a white colonial crusader, those are all synonyms for foreign, and therefore we need to throw you out. There is an ability in the Arab history and an Islamic text to look at the Jewish state and actually say, we recognize you as having a history here. And actually, the glory of Islam will be when we recognize you being here, not as foreigners. You will actually, this will bring the region to be whole. So systems of interpretations can change. So for me, acknowledging the theology plays a massive role in the conflict. And it's not just theology, it's sociology. If you're used to seeing the Jews as lesser than you for 1400 years across Arab and Muslim lands, you're not very quickly going to adjust to looking at them at eye level and thinking of them as your equals. I sometimes like to bring the example that as part of indicating the Jews as being of lower status across the Arab and Muslim world, they could not ride horses. Horses were a mark of dignity. They could only ride donkeys. Of course, they could not bear arms. They were protected. The idea of dhimmi means that you're protected by the mercy of the ruler. Look at the first images of the early Zionists, the Shomer. What do? They ride horses, they carry arms. Again, imagine the sociological shock, the theological shock of that transformation of what it means to be the Jew. But I'm not of the people. Some people say, oh, it's a religious conflict, and then their implication is, and therefore it can never change. And my answer is religion, sociology, theology play a massive role. But the assumption that therefore it is unchangeable, that's the one thing I don't accept. precisely because religions are systems of meaning and interpretation and reinterpretation.
It's interesting. It's also, I think you're talking about sociology and religion, also the issue of identity.
Yep.
Identity, absolutely. I think it's a very big deal. And we see it also in, you know, the Palestinian identity. I was once in this conflict group, kind of, you know, trying to talk about a new perspective to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then every one of the groups, we had the Israeli group and the Palestinian group, and every one of the groups had to write out five, like, dramatic moments of their nation, okay, like, key moments. And we started with Abraham, and then we, you know, we were thinking, okay, we can only do five. So how do? Do you do Abraham? No, do you do maybe, you know, Yitziat Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt, or do getting the Torah in Mount Sinai? Can we count it? We don't have enough. What do we do? And then, you know, the exile coming back, Spain, yes, no, Holocaust, yes, no, State of Israel. And there was a big discussion, Rabin assassination, you know, the more left wing in the group wanted it, the right wing were like, no, we have so many others. And we're like, arguing. And then the Palestinians come and they were like, the Balfour Declaration. Like, what? What? What are you talking about? The Balfour Declaration? You know, that's the... And I told them, listen, you know, and every one of their moments was about how the Jews were cruel towards the Palestinians. And I told them, listen, if we're trying to think of a new narrative to the conflict, a new way of perceiving the conflict, if your conflict is about identity, if your identity is based on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you will never give up the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because if you give it up, what's your identity? And then they said, you know, so your identity is based on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I told them, I agree that there were years that a lot of our identity was about conflict. Okay. But we always had more aspects to our identity. Also the religious identity, but also the Zionist identity. From day one, there were the kibbutzim, something we're very proud of. The Hebrew University in Jerusalem, you know, it was a big deal to come here with nothing and establish a university. And it was something we're very proud of. And also the National Library, you know, people escaped from Europe just before World War II and they established an amazing library in the center of Jerusalem, a library that till this day is a big deal, you know, and Startup Nation. And, you know, there are so many elements that make us proud that when we talk about them, we're proud. We're proud to be Israelis. And, you know, I told them maybe we need to think about other aspects of Palestinianness that is not about the conflict, not about the resistance. There was a very, like, true moment. I said, you know, maybe, to start movies. You know, maybe Ramallah can be the... you know, Arab Hollywood or something. You know, let's think about it. Or maybe it can be where, you know, thousands of books in Arabic are published. There are not many books that are translated into Arabic. You know, numbers, more books are translated to Hebrew than to Arabic. So, you know, let's do something like that. And, you know, like in the room, whatever. But then when we left the room, they said, you forget we're not living in a democracy. And you can't really do that without real democracy. Like, even if I come and suggest something like that, so very quickly will be about, you know, all the movies will have to be about the resistance and all the books will have to be about the resistance. And you can't translate this book and you can't do this movie and you don't want to fight with the religion and you don't want to fight with other countries and you can't do this and you can't do that. And that it was a sad moment. And it was also a very honest moment, I felt. But that does bring us to the fact that we do live in democracy. And I think this is part of the universal and particular kind of aspect that we have that is blended in Israel. And I wonder what you think about the way the American Jewish community, I mean, when you came in, I asked you, what is going on? Like, maybe you can give us a bit of a perspective, because I know this is something that you work on and talk about and research, and you first saw some of this.
So it's very much related to what you spoke about, the identity. I read it when you shared it in real time, and I thought it's very true. A lot of Israelis from the left describe certain moments when they meet with Palestinians and the Israelis come with all this goodwill, only to discover that the entire Palestinian identity is based on the negation of the Jewish state.
I'll like, just say that I was the right wing person in the group. Like I was brought in.
But it's, and that
the
is
the center, whatever. Yeah, you get, okay.
And by the way, that's the tragedy of the Palestinian identity, that it was created and sustained from the beginning as one that is based on negation, on destruction, not on a positive vision that says, okay, we want to build a state or we want independence, but one that says, first, it's more important for us that the Jews will not have a state than everything else. In my talks, as I talk about this process of realizing that this is what the Palestinian identity is, I bring a speech by Ernst Bevin when he goes to the British Parliament. He's the foreign minister of Britain after World War II. He goes to the British Parliament in February 47 to explain why Britain actually failed the mandate. It betrayed the Jewish people. It failed to carry out the trust that it received unanimously from the League of Nations. And in order to explain the British failure and betrayal, he says, His Majesty's government is faced with an irreconcilable conflict. And he calls it irreconcilable in February 47. It's no, there's no settlements, there's no occupation, there's no refugees. Like all the things that we are told are the problem don't exist yet. And he goes on to say the conflict is irreconcilable. February 47, he says, because this, the Jews in the land want a state as a top priority. And the Arabs in the land, those that are now known as Palestinians, as a top priority, he says, they want the Jews not to have a state in any part of the land. So from the beginning, the Palestinian identity, and again, as it becomes known, is based first and foremost on the negation of the Jewish state. So the path to peace involves first the transformation of the Palestinian identity away from negation and destruction towards construction. And this is where we get to this moment, because this is the tragedy and the danger, because I think we're at a grave moment of peril. Because over the years, let's look at the last century at who supported the Palestinians. And what the Arabs of the land, before they were known as Palestinians, what they discovered when they started battling the Jews is that this is actually a massive asset. Precisely because they were waging a total war against the Jews. And again, not against any Jews, against the Jews who dared expect liberty, dignity, sovereignty. The fact that the Arabs were waging a total war against these kinds of Jews meant that they could always draw on the support of every Jew-hating, anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist power of the moment. So in the 30s and 40s, they enjoy a very powerful collaboration with the Nazis. Today, we pretend that the Mufti and Hitler just had coffee once. The Mufti was part of the full Nazi system. He escaped trial in Nuremberg through a side deal. The Arabs had the same goals, the same plans for the Jews here, and they were only prevented from carrying them out by Montgomery and El Alamein. And when the Nazis are defeated, they are replaced by the Pan-Arabists that turned Palestinianism into this secular theology of what it means to be an Arab. And when the Pan-Arabists were defeated, they were replaced by the Soviets, who turned Palestinianism into a global cause by inserting it into international bodies, Zionism is racism, making the idea that Zionism is evil and laundering it through international bodies. And when the Soviet Union was over, Iran stepped into the fray to be kind of the supporter. And you're beginning to see a theme here. First of all, that all supporters of Palestinianism ended in the dustbin of history. Why? Because it's an ideology of destruction and negation and scapegoating. So every society that uses it is basically a failed society. By and large, anti-Zionism hiding behind the mask of Palestinianism is the ideology of failed societies. Why am I concerned? Because I have no doubt that the Iranians and the current extreme leftists, they will also end up in the dustbin of history like all their predecessors. The problem is that on their way to the dustbin of history, they cause a lot of damage to the Jewish people and to the world at large. The Nazis, the Pan-Arabists, within 2 decades, no Jews are left from Morocco to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
The Soviet Union, we know how they treated their Jews. Iran, we're seeing what's happening on American campuses today. So I just came back from a talk, from a series of talks in the U.S., and I came with a very dark message. I said, this is a moment of peril. It's nothing, there is a real danger to Jewish life under this mask of anti-Zionism, Palestinianism. And if we do not fight against it, it always ends in the same way, with no Jews being left. And I told the Jews, you spoke about Tikkun Olam, I told them, this is the moment to take care of ourselves. And I know that this is not the message that Jews are used to hearing. We want to take care of everybody else. You know, we are always allies to every social justice cause, Tikkun Olam. And I basically said, not now. Not right now. Now is the moment, like they tell you in all those self-care places, workshops, right? You want to care for the world? You want to care for everybody else? First, take care of yourselves. This is the moment for the Jewish people, both here and around the world. We need to take care of ourselves. We need to be very clear about who our allies are and not kind of close our eyes and fudge the issues. All the investments that we made in the broader society, this is the moment to bring them home. This is the moment to invest in our defense, in our strength, in our ability. This is right now not the moment to take care of everybody else.
And what do you think that means regarding the campuses?
First of all, it means that all the money that went to universities by Jews should no longer go there. It should go to the Jewish people. However, do you want to establish new universities? You want to send all the Jews to Israeli universities? But this is not the moment to support other institutions that are not squarely, clearly standing with the Jewish people and with the state of Israel and with Zionism. If there are universities that want to pick up the mantle, if there are universities in America that are saying, come to us, we are not confused, we will stand by you, we understand the peril of this moment, and we will not throw you under the bus, invest in them. But this is not the moment to kind of pretend that everything is okay, because it's not. And again, the historical record is clear. If anti-Zionism is allowed to become the dominant ideology of a campus, of the Democratic Party, then again, no Jews are left. And they always claim, the Arabs, they always say they have nothing against Jews. They love Jews, really. The problem is not with Jews. And yet somehow, no Jews are left at the end.
Well, what you're saying is pretty radical. First of all, do you think the American Jewish community, do you think that's something that could happen? Can you imagine it?
I can tell you that a lot of people have woken up after October 7th to really understand who their friends are, who their allies are. Because we see in America that when people stand by the Jewish people, they do it clearly. People like John Fetterman or Congressman Richie Torres, they are not confused for a second. And by the way, it's not a coincidence. Like I said, anti-Zionism is the ideology of losers. It's the ideology of failed societies that because they are failed, they need a scapegoat. So they go for the classical Jewish scapegoat. People and societies that are confident, forward-looking, building, successful. It's not a coincidence that the more successful countries in the Arab world now are the ones that are also beginning to reinterpret Islam and the Arab identity away from anti-Zionism, because they don't need a scapegoat anymore, because they don't need a scapegoat away from their failures. So it's not a coincidence that people who have a sense of confidence, they're not looking to scapegoat others, they're standing with us.
So again, do you think the American Jewish community, do you think this is something that
they'll have no choice? Okay. We have no choice. They have no choice. I mean, it's not as if like there's choice here. As I said, the historical record is definite. Someone asked me when I said, do you have an example where you fight back and it succeeds? So I had only one example, which is Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, where, again, Jeremy Corbyn is the classic anti-Zionist, yeah, not anti-Semite. He genuinely, you know, he, yeah, doesn't hate Jews. But what he didn't understand, that this is not personal. It's not about your personal prejudice. Who do you hate or not? It's about the structure. And when he brought into the Labour Party anti-Zionism as the structural ideology, within weeks and months, it became a cesspool of Jew hatred, and Jewish members of parliament felt that they had to leave. And Jews in Britain felt that if Jeremy Corbyn will be prime minister, it will be the end of Jewish life in Britain, or the second or third end. And they fought back and they brought him down politically. So I said, okay, I have this example, but then Jews in Britain tell me, we're not sure you can pocket this example yet, because we're not sure it's over. We're not sure that we can say, okay, we kind of fought this back, we pushed them back to the margins and it's over. I will say this, in the UK and in the US, going back to theology, there is a strong undercurrent of philo-Semitism, of the belief that to be British, to be American, means to stand with the Jewish people, and again, to stand with Zionism and to, yeah, stand with the Jewish, yeah, state. Hopefully that undercurrent will be powerful enough to push against the undercurrent that only wants to see Jews who are powerless and who play the role of meek and subservient. But it is very much a battle where, again, Jews will have no choice but to be very clear on where they stand in this battle. And I will say this, Jews who think Churchill described appeasement as feeding the crocodile in the hope that he will eat you last. This is an ancient Jewish view that you will throw your people under the bus in the hope that you will be saved. So the Jews who are siding with the most virulent anti-Zionists in the thinking that they will be spared never works.
No, that never works.
So I think the lines are being drawn, and Jews will very clearly have to mobilize for the defense of our people. I don't think there's going to be much choice.
So how do you think ideologically, like how, I think that part of the American Jewish story is a lot of the liberal story. It's a lot about tikkun olam, as you were saying. And I think that to tell people, just put it aside, I think that's a big challenge. I wonder, I hear you and I understand what you're saying. I want to try looking at it from a different perspective. You see, Zionism from day one was very democratic. It was very much about Tikkun Olam. The State of Israel from day one was a lot about Tikkun Olam. There are two major changes in the world that happened because of the Holocaust. One was the Declaration of Independence and the fact that the State of Israel was born. And the second was the Declaration of the Human Rights of the UN, which today maybe is perceived as a big mess. I can say it that way, or I'll say it nice. So today may be perceived very differently, but that was a major change in the world. The fact that, you know, everyone has the right to live, you know, there are human rights. And both were as a result of the Holocaust, and both were promoted by Jews because of the Holocaust, because they knew what it means to be landless, to be rightless. And I wonder if this moment is a moment that we can again think about these challenges, how they're embedded. And instead of being either or, you know, either we support our group so we can live and exist, or we don't support our group, maybe we can think of it as, and I think that's also something that could be, you know, could give us a good option for the future of how Judaism and Zionism, which, like you were saying, and I agree, we look back and look for something that you know, strengthens our point, our perspective. But I think that it's not only that. Really, Zionism from day one was a very, you know, it was egalitarian. Women got the right to vote in the Third Congress, you know. And we were, from day one, we were very democratic, and that was a big notion. And it was in days that many countries weren't democratic, and Israel was a country that was born as a democracy. So we have here something that's very strong, and also not only in Zionism, also in Judaism, you know, this not only the idea of Tikkun Olam, also the idea that, you know, all men and women were born in the face of God. And there's so much of this. And I wonder if we can think about this moment and maybe crystallize something, like maybe because of the huge challenge, and really, these are such hard days. And I think about how the Holocaust gave us, the horrible Holocaust, a lot of my family was perished on the Holocaust. We knew how to strengthen from the Holocaust and how to change the world and to turn it into a better place. And I'm wondering if this is a moment that we can redefine or think about it differently and maybe bridge the gap. Or
so I'll be a little more harsh and cynical. This is a very specific moment. So let's think before the Holocaust. Jews, their contribution to Europe, to Germany above all, was worthless at the critical moment. Everything that they gave, everything that they did to make Germany what it was, mattered for exactly a big fat zero when they were turned into the scapegoat of Germans' misery and failure.
Okay, so now I have to tell you a story about my great-grandmother, Frieda Friedman. Mm-hmm. She, in 1933, when Hitler got in power, she wrote a letter to Hindenburg. And she told him that two of her brothers were killed in World War I, and her fiancé, too. And another brother came back wounded. And she ended up marrying my great-grandfather, Martin, that was always also wounded twice in World War I. Mm-hmm. She said, we're always proud and committed and loyal citizens of Germany. And it was 1933. And she says, how come there are people marching down the streets yelling against the Jews and blaming us for everything when we're only 1% of the population? Hindenburg answered her and told her, I'm taking very seriously your letter. Hindenburg, he was, you know, he was the leader of World War I, and he was, and also Jews were appreciated him, and he appreciated Jews and whatever. And he sent the letter to Hitler to answer. And Hitler wrote in his handwriting, it's a big lie or whatever, blah, 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 she's lying. And we found that letter years later. Amazing. We knew there was something, but it's, first of all, I just want to say, apparently it's a very important letter because it's the first time that Hitler wrote something in his handwriting since he got into power. And I always think about my great grandmother's capability to drive him crazy enough that he wrote down. I think the sentence of, I don't know if it's a sign of strength or weakness. I think that's what, like, you know, made him, made him flip or whatever. And the second thing is that's exactly the story.
Yeah.
And a lot of German Jews, men, after they escaped the Holocaust, they died of heart diseases because they couldn't, that's where I see it.
It was heartbreak. Look, the Jews of the Arab world, they contributed so much to that society. The Arab world could do nothing more stupid than ethnically cleanse Jewish communities, some of them predating the Arab and Muslim conquest, and yet they did that. We are seeing Jews in America now waking up to discover that all their support for all the other social justice causes in America right now are giving them zero credit. They are finding that they were allies to everybody else, but the day that they needed people to stand with them, again, except for some strong, confident voices, they realized that those investments in being allies were worthless. So I'm not saying don't contribute to the world. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying not this moment. This is the moment to take care of our own. The state of Israel was not established because of the Holocaust. Quite the contrary. After the Holocaust is one of the greatest successes of the Arab resistance. It's not sufficiently highlighted that the state of Israel was supposed to be established in the 1930s. Everything was prepared for that.
Yeah, that's true.
But also because of the
Balfour Declaration.
Exactly.
Was
and the Arab violence and the British betrayal closed the gates and prevented the establishment of a Jewish state. And hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Jews, were condemned to genocide, a real one, in Europe, because the Arabs fought the Jewish state already in the 20s. And that is something that should be known. The Jewish state was ready in the 30s because of the Zionist
movement.
Constructive vision.
Yeah.
You know that after the Holocaust, everyone thought that there would be no Jewish state because there's no Jews. That was actually about to be a huge Arab success. And still, the Jewish people were able to pick themselves up and still fight for a sovereign state. So it's everything. We created these things. And you talked about Jews creating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Look at what's happening now. All the human rights organizations, they're all being perverted, abused, in order to turn Jewish sovereignty into a toxic word. So all I'm saying, our contributions to the world are important, but right now, this is a moment of peril, and right now, we need to take care of ourselves. Once we secure ourselves, we can take care of everybody else.
Yeah, I just wonder if taking... I think that's the part that I wonder. I think that the fact that the state of Israel was born... It is taking care of ourselves, of course, but it was also inspiration for many other countries.
Certainly.
And it wasn't only, like, I think, and also from the moment the state of Israel was born, we immediately went to work in agriculture, in Africa. And, you know, we always had that aspect to us. You know, I think what I wonder is, do we do good to expect to receive good? Do we do good because that's part of being a Jewish nation?
I think it's part of who we are, but I'm saying right now, this is a moment.
No, I agree.
To take care of ourselves.
I have to say, I agree that we need to take care of ourselves. I think what I'm hoping to find is, or what I believe, is that doesn't have to be either or.
Over the long run, it's like
it's
I say about women. You know, can women have it all? I always say yes. But not all at once, not at every single moment. The same way, can we do both? Of course. Can we do both right now? I don't think so.
Interesting. Okay. Do you want to say a word about what's happening on the campuses?
Well, what's happening on the campuses is that this ideology of anti-Zionism masking behind Palestinianism has gone global.
Mm-hmm.
It's entered America. And as I said, nothing good waits at the end of this.
Yeah, that's
so either it's pushed to the margins, or again, nothing good awaits for the Jewish people in America if this is allowed to run free.
And also, I think universities, like, you know, it would be very hard for these universities to be Ivy League universities with this.
Look, the German universities lost all prestige. No one ever thinks today about a German university as being a serious university.
Yeah. Okay, so I hope you have a nice Independence Day. This was more harsh than I expected. I'll be honest. No, it's okay. It's okay. Any wishes for the American Jewish community, for Israel?
When I said these things in my recent talks in the U.S., I told them, look, I'm not even sure I should speak anymore because people want uplifting and optimistic. And I told them it's not the message that I have for you right now. But a lot of people came to me at the end and they said, you know, we know you think it's not inspirational or uplifting, but we felt we were crazy, that we saw things, and at least to know that we're not alone in what we're saying, they said it means a lot.
So I want to say something about Jewish history. Every time Jews become very, very strong, that's the moment before the big fall arrives. Traveling in Spain, my husband and I went on a trip to Spain, and we went to see, and there is the most ancient mikveh in Spain. And it's, you know, you could see it was gorgeous, okay? And it was built just before the Jewish exile. They finished building it. I don't know even how many years they enjoyed it. And it was after centuries of Jews in Spain. And the same thing also when you go travel through Europe and you see the gorgeous shuls, the gorgeous synagogues. So many of them, I remember in, I think it was, I don't remember where, I think in Czech. I don't remember which, where, Czech Republic. No, it wasn't there. Never mind. I don't remember where. But you come in and you see this gorgeous shul. And it's always just before the Holocaust. They finished building it just before the Holocaust. And when Hillary was running for president against Trump, I was standing in my kitchen talking to my husband. And I remember I told him, this is interesting. Both of them have Jewish grandchildren or married Jewish. Never mind, you know, how you, yeah. But they both married Jews. I was like, this is the, you know, the strongest moment of the American Jewish community. And then I looked at him and I said, does this mean that it's going to fall apart like it has always happened throughout history? And, you know, I think that there are two reasons that it might not happen. One is because the state of Israel is here and we're, you know, we're here.
We have to work on that too.
Okay, that I agree, but that's for another talk. State of Israel is here. And the second is that it's in a liberal democracy with history of liberal democracy. And I wonder how the story would be unfolded. But, you know, I think that the American Jewish community, and you did talk about like the philo-Semitism, right? Like there is also some of that that's happening. And in democracy, it's not, there is, you know, we are in the era of populism. So there could be, you know, that's the only voice we can hear, but it might be, we might have a different end to the story. And I want to hope that we'll have a different end to the story. And I want to hope it
will be the actual proof of American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
If there's a different end
that,
to the story.
That America is a great nation. I mean, and as a half American, I had to renounce my citizenship when I became a member of the Israeli parliament. And, you know, I think I still have a lot of pride towards the United States of America. So I do hope that the story will be a different story. I think a lot of people hope. I say also for the American Jewish community, but also for Israel, because we do need, America has always been our, you know,
not always
biggest friend,
but
yeah,
the Soviets,
but you know,
the French, but
yeah, but at the end of the day,
it's important to have America,
as you said, in the long run.
Yes.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was very interesting. I hope next time we meet, it will be a little more optimistic. Hopefully. Time will tell.
Yes.
Time will tell. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Chag Atzmaut Sameach.
Chag Sameach.